Artbeat with Catherine Davis on Talk 1260 KTRC.
Hello, folks. This is Catherine Davis. I'm your host, and this is Artbeat. You're listening to Talk 1260 KTRC. We stream live on santafe.com, where you can also download our podcast. And today in the studio, my first guest is Charlotte Jackson. Welcome, Charlotte.
Thank you, Catherine.
It's good to have you here. Now, you are here on behalf of your gallery. You're showing a group of images, and we'll get into this in just a little bit, by Ronald Davis, who is an artist who lives in Arroyo Hondo near Taos.
Right.
And has lived in Los Angeles and has quite an extensive background. This is a show called Pixel Dust Renderings 2012. But first, let's back up a little bit and talk about you, Charlotte. You've been in the gallery business here in Santa Fe for quite some time.
About 25 years.
Uh-huh.
Long time.
And you just moved from the downtown area to the Rail Yard.
That's right. We moved in 2010 into the Rail Yard area, and it's been great. We were downtown for 23 years, so this has been a real kind of major leap for us in terms of sort of putting ourselves out into the real public and also in terms of the space itself.
It's a beautiful space.
It is a wonderful space, thanks to Trey Jordan, who was the architect on the interior. So,
and let's give out the specifics, the contact information, because I just start assuming everybody knows where you are, and of course they might not. We are talking about Charlotte Jackson Fine Art Gallery. You are located in the Rail Yard Art District at 554 South Guadalupe.
Correct.
Near Paseo de Peralta. And what is the gallery website and the phone number?
The phone number is 989-8688.
Mm-hmm.
And the website is www.charlottejackson.com.
Right. Okay. So, Charlotte, you, I'd say your gallery is known for carrying artists who tended to be popular, who became popular in the 60s, whose work has been very instrumental to really how we understand art today. A lot of crossover from the L.A., Taos, New Mexico scene. And Ron certainly fits in that genre, as it were, although it's really hard to confine him, because we were talking a little before the show started, and it occurred to me that Ron Davis is a very Leonardo-esque kind of a figure. He's dealing in mathematics. He's dealing with science. He's bringing them together in the visual arts in a really spectacular way. Tell us your history with the artist.
Well, Ron and I have been working together for the last three and a half years.
Mm-hmm.
He had been a very well-known artist in California, in Los Angeles, with the Ferris Gallery and that whole Pacific Standard Time group of artists.
Right.
He was with Leo Castelli in New York. I mean, he
has had
an amazing background with amazing dealers and museums throughout the world. He has a dodecagon in the Tate in the Museum of Modern Art in New York.
And
all
let's
over
back
the world.
Up. I had to double check the meaning and the pronunciation of the word.
Dodecagon, yeah.
That's a 12-sided form. So Ron is associated, I'd say, primarily with geometric abstraction, shaped canvas painting, even color field painting. We can, again, back up and talk about some of those influences.
I mean, he was actually doing monochrome painting in the 60s when nobody else was doing monochrome painting. I mean, he's really been a pioneer in a lot of the materials that he's using. I mean, the dodecagons were resin. They were actually molded, poured resin. He would actually make the mold for the dodecagon and then pour the material in flat. So he never knew what it was going to look like till he took the mold off and turned it over. So, I mean, he really has been on the forefront of a lot of materials that other artists have not used, or if they have, they sort of left it behind, and he continued to explore it even more, which is Which brings us to what he's doing now, this sort of this 3D thing, because he started right. looking at that in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So he's really has been on the cutting edge of a lot of this new material.
I'll say, I mean, the fact that he had his solo exhibition at Leo Castelli Gallery in 1968, I mean, these are the days of Rauschenberg and Johns. I understand that Davis was taught by abstract expressionists, but he moved forward out of this color field sensibility. And I liked what it said on the internet. I did a little bit of research about him. And it says that he was really concerned, not just with the California interest, like the Finnish fetish,
right,
but how to, and I'm quoting, how to reconcile the literal object produced with the latest technology with transcendental metaphor. And that's the problem that occupied him throughout the 60s and many artists like him.
Exactly.
So we're looking at the object itself in a Donald Judd-esque kind of way. The object itself takes prominence, not as much as with the abstract expressionists like Motherwell, the intention of conveying deep emotional states.
Right, exactly. He is a mathematician.
Right.
Math is something that is important to him, that he finds very interesting. You know, he is comparing himself, if you look at some of what he's talking about with his new work, with Duchamp and Paolo Uccello.
Uccello from the Florentine Renaissance.
Right,
artists.
Exactly. And if you look at, if you go in and you Google those artists, you see the similarity and mm-hmm. the relationship and a dialogue with what Ron mm-hmm. is doing now, which is mm-hmm. very exciting. Again, I mean, this constantly being, you know, stepping in and out of the past and the present and the future.
And tying together all of those concepts in this profound consideration of what is the art object?
Exactly.
What is the purpose of it? And now he's kind of stepped out even further from making a three-dimensional image that we would look at as if it were a sculpture,
right,
to flattening that image and presenting it on the wall on these aluminum transfers. And I'm going to have you describe the process just a little bit.
Okay.
But it's an amazing concept and context. And I just want to tell people that Charlotte's shown me one of these pieces, and I'm looking at photographs of these images, and they absolutely look as if I should be able to reach out and touch these in the three and four dimensions of
exactly.
time and space.
Yep.
So tell us how he does this.
Well, that's a tall order because
you're not Ron.
I'm not Ron, and Ron is interesting. He in the 80s he started working on Macintosh, and he was working on started exploring sort of this 3D programming. And, you know, as that changed, he's always stayed involved with this computer, mm-hmm. these computer programs in terms of what's happening in this three-dimensional space. And so this pixel dust, as he refers mm-hmm. to it, is his own definition of using this 3D form,
mm-hmm.
computer form. And it's the same kind of thing that's used in a lot of the Disney
right.
new generated cartoons.
Pixar 3D
exactly,
processes.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I noticed that from your gallery PR, the artist considers pixel dust to be his medium, and
right.
what it is particles of light. And then he will manipulate those digitally, if I'm understanding
exactly.
this correctly, so that he creates these objects that look entirely, even beyond three dimensions. You feel, like you were commenting, Charlotte, like you can just reach into these flat images.
And just put your hand inside them. You feel like if you there are different forms, July box. I mean, you feel as though you could just step up and slip your hand inside there.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they are so three-dimensional on the wall. And he has really managed to, and we understand how he can create that on a computer screen.
Sure.
But for him to be able to transfer that in this format on aluminum is very fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And the larger you get, the more interesting they become. So the largest work in the show are these 42 by 42s, which fascinating. I mean, you really feel as though you could step inside this form, mm-hmm. whatever form he chooses to use for the show, for these individual pieces.
And you pointed out to me that he is creating the illusion of a frame on these flat aluminum pieces of aluminum, so that he's really playing with this idea of the object, the three-dimensional object, as portrayed as a two-dimensional work of art.
Exactly.
And I think that's where the tie-in to Duchamp comes in. I think we'll talk after the break about these great connections with Uccello, Duchamp, and others. We'll come back to that.
Good.
But it's just really fascinating. And I want to make sure that people understand, the people who are listening, understand that these are highly colorful pieces too.
Very. And that's, Ron has always been
saturated.
A colorist.
I mean,
he really is about color. And, you know, no matter what series he was working on, whether it was the music series or the dodecagons or the monochromes, each series was about color.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are no exception.
Right. You can tell this is a man who has quite an extensive background in painting, color theory, et cetera. I would expect that he probably secretly writes backwards just like Leonardo.
Yeah.
Right.
He very well might. I don't know. I can't swear to that, but he could.
He seems like a brilliant man. And we will come back and talk a little bit more about the art history behind what Ron Davis is doing at Charlotte Jackson Fine Art. We'll be right back. You're listening to Art Beat on Talk 1260 KTRC, streaming live on SantaFe.com. Welcome back to Art Beat. This is Catherine Davis, and my guest is Charlotte Jackson. Hi, Charlotte.
Hi.
We're talking about the artist Ron Davis and the show that you've opened this weekend, Pixel Dust Renderings 2012. Now, tell us about, Ron has a very important history. He was born, for the listeners' information, he was born in 1937. He has quite an extensive history as a very well-known and important American artist. Tell us more.
He does. He was born in California and then went to live in Wyoming, where he went to school. He did also do a stint at Yale. Mm-hmm. He has received all kinds of awards, national awards, National Endowment Awards. He's, again, been in major exhibitions throughout the world. The latest one was, of course, the Pacific Standard Time exhibition, where he had two huge dodecagons, one that was on loan from the Tate and another one that was on loan from a private collector in Los Angeles. That show then went on to Berlin, where they took another dodecagon for exhibition in Berlin. So he really has had a very extensive career and continued to work throughout this whole time frame. Until about 10 years ago, where he stopped working and he moved to Taos from California.
Mm-hmm.
I want to back up just a little bit, though, and say that when he was in Wyoming, one of the things that he recently told me and I was absolutely fascinated by was the fact that he raced MGs. And we talked about what kind of MGs he had. He had MGAs, and I don't think he had an MGB, but anyone who knows MGs knows that they are the kind of car that you're always fooling with and fiddling with, and he loved doing that, and he loved racing cars. So
he's a tinkerer.
He is a tinkerer in that sense, and I think that also shows up in the work that he did
absolutely
throughout his lifetime. He is 76. He does live in Arroyo Hondo, which is outside of Taos, and he is working. The work that he's doing now, the pixel dust renderings, are what his current work.
Mm-hmm.
In 2010, he started doing a body of work, which was work that he did on PVC.
Hmm.
And he was using a high-load acrylic. He used a roller, and he rolled the paint onto the surface, which gave it a fabulous surface. Again, he was actually etching into the surface so that you have this three-dimensional, once again, using that three-dimensional format where when you put it on the wall, you feel like it has a life of its own, where mm-hmm. it does, from certain angles, it becomes very much three-dimensional.
Mm-hmm. And it's not, I think the impression that I want to leave our listeners with is that his work is not so much about optical illusion.
No.
It's really not about optical illusion. It's more about the thingness of
and
the object itself,
right.
as it exists in space.
Yes, and also this mathematics, and I come back to that again.
Right.
Mathematics is very important to him. And, you know, looking at putting together these pieces, whether it's the PVCs or whether it's a dodecagon or whether it's the pixel dust renderings, this is very much a root of what he's interested mm-hmm. In terms of exploring and having the final image have a mathematical mm-hmm. equation to it.
So even though I think your first impression as you're going to walk into the gallery and see what about 18 works on the walls,
right.
Saturated, brilliant colors, fantastic forms, but all two-dimensional on the wall, I think that people are going to be struck not so much by this highly conceptual, very mathematical, very theoretical work. They're going to be struck by the objectness of the work.
And the color.
And the colors, absolutely.
And then trying to understand how he did it. And that's
mm-hmm.
probably the most common question that we hear over and over again is, well, how did he do this? I don't understand this. And frankly, we are still learning how he does it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's very forthright in terms of talking about the process, but, you know, for the layperson getting their head around that process, and I have to say I fall in that category as well, of how this actually works is very unique. And I think that we touched a little bit about what happens. He does, in fact, construct these on a computer, and then they actually get transferred onto aluminum. And
mm-hmm.
he found this man who makes signs in Akron, Ohio, and he taught him how to do this. And so he's working with 125-year archival pigment.
So the color will last
it's
for
color
125
fast. Exactly.
years,
exactly.
at least.
And
after that, they can come back and talk to you about it, right?
That's right, because I'll still be here, right? and Ron will be, too.
Exactly.
But I think that this process is unique to Ron in terms of
mm-hmm.
how he actually, it's heat transferred onto these aluminum panels.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it gets a little bit tricky. So, you know, that might be a conversation to have with Ron directly. But I do think that it's one of the things that people ask, because when you come in, you see these pieces that are flat to the wall, but you feel as though they are three-dimensional. And as you move around them, they move with you.
Mm-hmm.
So they're constantly
holographic.
Yeah,
in that,
exactly. They do have a holographic sensation to them.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And that's actually a very good way to describe that in a sense.
But they're not holograms.
Right.
No,
they're not like a Terrell. They are a Ron
right.
Davis.
Right. They're not a Larry Bell.
Right. There are these three-dimensional images on a flat plane
mm-hmm.
that you want to move because you want to try to understand what's happening, but they are
mm-hmm.
unique to Ron Davis.
And he's had such significant art writers as Michael Fried, Barbara Rose have written about Ron Davis's work. And one of the things that, some of the things that they've brought up are these ideas, again, going back to the mathematical perspective, one-point perspective, of an artist like Uccello from Florence in
right.
in the early Renaissance period, the perspective of Marcel Duchamp in his large glass piece, the push and pull, the tension of that flat surface, moving in and out of three dimensionality as taught by Hans Hofmann, all of these aspects are there in his work, and at the same time, they stand alone as fascinating objects. Beautiful objects, beautiful to behold.
That's true. And I just got an email recently from Barbara Rose, who had, when she was here last summer, as a lecturer, she met with Ron and they had a great reunion because they had been good friends in the early years. And she talks about Ron and how brilliant he is and what a brilliant artist he is. And she's interested in recreating an exhibition that she did in 1966 that Ron Davis was a part of, called The New Aesthetic. So we may get to see something like that, and, you know, with Ron incorporated in that as well. So it's been a great relationship to have Ron involved in the gallery and bringing other wonderful people like Barbara Davis and Michael Fried to the forefront of the gallery as well.
Well, everyone can come see the show. It's opened this weekend, running through February 25th.
That's correct.
So basically through the end
Most of
February.
Yeah.
And again, that's at Charlotte Jackson Fine Art in the Rail Yard Art District, 554 South Guadalupe. And you've been listening to Charlotte Jackson. And this is Art Beat with Catherine Davis. We're on Talk 1260 KTRC, streaming live on SantaFe.com. Welcome back to Art Beat. This is Catherine Davis, and you're listening to Talk 1260 KTRC. We stream live on SantaFe.com, where you can also go to download our podcast. Now, my guest for this segment comes to us from Zane Bennett Contemporary Art, and you've been on the show before. Welcome back, Meg Hoffman.
Thank you so much, Catherine.
You're in charge of special projects at Zane Bennett.
Yes.
And you have put together from the gallery collection a show called Black Space.
Correct.
That's open this weekend and will run to mid-February, February 15th. And this show is a show of works featuring the color and the feel black, which you note in your press release, black has been used as a basis for painting since prehistoric cave drawings.
Right.
It's an element. I mean, it's a basic element of art.
Yes, it is. And black, I think this show is particularly interesting because it really draws from work from the 50s and the 60s, where art was changing. So it was modernism. That's always the cutoff. Generally, we say modernism was World War II, and that was the end. So this is a new era. A lot of artists wanted to do something very different. And so one of the artists that we are featuring is Pierre Soulages, and he's a Frenchman. He's passed now. But he was called the painter of black. He was one of the first artists to really use black as just the basis for his paintings.
And I like, excuse my interruption here. I just wanted to mention, you have in the press release a quote from him that he felt that black opened up a mental field all its own. And I'm looking at an image of a lithography piece, number 26. The way he uses black is incredible. He didn't just put black down on a prepared canvas, but he used layers and layers of white and blue and yellow and red and orange and brown, and then went over that with black that he then scrapes away with brushes or towels or palette knives. So there's this very layered quality to the piece.
And so the striations in the black allow the color to shine through, and it sort of creates like a stained glass painting. You know, or a stained glass window, excuse me. Yes, it is a stained glass painting. And this, you can see that in his work. One of the earliest ones we have is a 1953 piece, and it's called Old Fort, number one. And that is a very historic piece. That's a really, because this is one of the first pieces where you actually saw an artist using black and then having colors underneath it. The show also features another artist that considered black to be inspirational, and that was Ellsworth Kelly.
Yes.
Kelly went to France when he was a young student, young man, and one of his first paintings that attracted a lot of attention was one called Seine, which is referring to the river Seine
in Paris.
And he saw black and white triangles, rectangles, sort of in the water. So then he took that imagery and, you know, did a painting with just black and white rectangles. And this was huge. This
and
was
I
very
noticed,
huge.
I noticed in the press release, which I bet you wrote, huh?
Yes, I did.
You have rectangles arranged by chance, which of course makes me think of Hans or Jean Arp.
Right.
And the Dada movement,
right.
Which is quickly followed by the Surrealist movement.
Right.
Which I think those are important components of the movement that follows the New York School of Abstract Expressionism, and then Ellsworth Kelly grows out of that into
right.
his shaped canvases.
Right. And another, you know, there were a whole, you know, group of young artists trying to create the most different, something completely different than what
right.
was happening before.
Right.
And so they sort of wanted to objectify things,
mm-hmm.
Which meant
rather than conveying big fields of
right.
color that might convey
well,
emotional
you know,
state.
Well, that's the funny thing, because some of the artists talked about emotional
right.
emotional expression.
Like Motherwell.
Right. Motherwell talked about that. But then you have someone contrasting like Donald Judd.
Exactly.
And Donald Judd, he's actually considered, you know, the sort of high priest of minimalism. Not that he wanted that label.
No, he didn't like being
No, he
that.
Didn't like being referred to in minimalist because he had his own thing. But he actually did a manifesto, and
yes.
it was called Specific Objects. And Judd is someone who...
And by the way, these artists are all in the show. Let's go
correct.
Ahead and,
Donald
name...
Judd's piece is in. It's,
right.
you know, it's called Untitled Shellman, number 89.
So besides Pierre Soulages and Ellsworth Kelly, there's Motherwell.
There's Robert Motherwell. We have several pieces of his. Ellsworth Kelly, we have a lot of his work.
Good.
You know, Ellsworth Kelly is interesting because he sort of took the shape construct
mm-hmm.
the way Donald Judd did, but Donald Judd was into making objects.
Yes.
And he never referred to his work as sculpture. He referred to them as objects because he
right.
really believed that the objects had an inherent value just
on their
in
own.
Them on their own. So
yeah.
he really sort of stripped emotionalism out of the picture.
Absolutely.
It was
and
a very
it's
intellectual.
Funny, as you're bringing up, and when we had talked about earlier with Charlotte Jackson in the first segment of the show, how artists at this time are really concerned, many of them are concerned, like Judd is, with the thingness
yes.
of the artwork itself.
Yes.
That it's not representing anything necessarily.
That's right. It's not representing nature. It's not representing mm-hmm. an emotion.
Right.
It's not representing anything in daily life.
But the funny thing about minimalism, and I think Judd would just die on hearing this, which I'm sure wouldn't have been news to him, so many people invest a lot of feeling into minimalist and monochromatic works because they're so open and so transcendent in this Zen-like way.
Right. Yes. That's a funny contrast there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's hard to explain because then people will project their own
right.
experience or what they're feeling when they see this sort of vast, you know, empty or very full space.
Right. It's a thing that confronts us with almost an existential angst
mm-hmm.
of who am I? What am I doing here?
That's
which
right.
can be experienced very peacefully, very calmly, or it can just induce a feeling of panic like, ah,
right. Well, Rothko, for instance, you
uh-huh.
know, he did the big color fields, but those are very, very powerful pieces. And mm-hmm. I remember when I first experienced one of his paintings, and it was absolutely huge. It took an entire wall. And it was an overwhelming experience. It was fabulous.
Did you cry? I remember crying in
yeah,
front of the Rothkos.
Yeah, I know. I did.
Yeah.
I did. It's very intense. It was
mm-hmm.
very intense. And there, that simplicity, I think, is part of what a lot of this work is about.
Mm-hmm. And what's more basic than black? I mean, we turn to it in fashion.
I know. Well, it's sort of, you know, black takes care of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you start layering colors in, that's when dynamics start changing as
mm-hmm.
well. And all of these artists, you know, introduce color at some point in their work. You know, with Soulages, he was really one of the first,
mm-hmm.
you know, with a stained glass window kind of thing.
Well, but he actually, this is an interesting note that I just noticed in the press release. He made 104 stained glass windows for the Romanesque Abbey Church at St. patois, which I have taught about in the classes on Romanesque art and architecture.
Yes, yes. So I know he's really was amazing, you know. And the stained glass window, we all love stained glass window because it mm-hmm. is a very transcending experience, seeing mm-hmm. light streaming through. And that's one of the interesting things about the Black Show is really it's about light, mm-hmm. even though it's black.
Strangely enough.
Yeah. Strangely, because
absence suggests the presence. The
exactly.
absence of light, which is black, suggests the presence of light.
And that's
color.
What they were really dealing with a lot. When mm-hmm. you see some of the big Ellsworth Kelly, he did these big triangles. I mean, they're very large triangles of varying sort of curvy shapes. And, you know, when you look at them, you think, oh, my gosh, it's just a black triangle. But actually, when you see them in person, they are huge brushstrokes. These are prints, but these mm-hmm. are huge brushstrokes on the stone. On the litho stone, mm-hmm. which allow the whole triangle to sort of vibrate.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's about the light,
and right? The object in space and time. I've noticed
that's right.
Ellsworth Kelly pieces can tend to appear to start whirling in front of you.
Yes,
even
they do.
They don't.
They don't.
All,
they're
literally.
Completely stable and, uh-huh. and static. But because of the brush strokes and because of what your eye does when they're trying to see the light. In relationship to the black, you see movement. You have
right.
movement.
Right. And there's quite a lot of movement in the pieces that I'm seeing images of. Mm-hmm. Besides Soulages and Kelly, Judd's pieces imply movement.
Yes, and Judd's pieces, you can't really see it in person. When you see the actual work, there's almost like a star-like quality in the light mm-hmm. coming through. And that's a very interesting, because there's a shimmering thing that happens then. So that's another aspect of the light
mm-hmm.
And, you know, what it does to you when you look at it.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like it's going to be a fantastic show. And once again, I have done my evil deed of assuming that everybody knows where Zane Bennett Contemporary Art is and everybody knows you, Meg. But let's... Let's fix that just
right.
in case they don't.
It's 435 South Guadalupe across from Tomasita's.
Yes.
So you can't miss it.
In the Rail Yard Arts District.
In the Rail Yard Arts District.
And the show has opened this weekend, but it's up until February 15th. Mm-hmm. And again, give us the gallery phone number and web address.
Yes. It's the address is 505-982-8111. And the web address...
Zane Bennett. Two T's
and gallery. Two N's, gallery.com. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Zane Bennett Gallery, .com and 982-8111. And we will come back and discuss a little bit further with Meg Hockman, this show, Black Space. You're listening to Talk 1260 KTRC. This is Art Beat, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Art Beat. I'm Catherine Davis, and my guest is Meg Hockman, Special Project Coordinator for Zane Bennett Contemporary Art. Hi, Meg.
Hi.
And I just wanted to tell the listeners, Meg and I were talking during the break, and I really want to give kudos to you, Meg, for putting together a show of works by artists who theoretically, philosophically, have these really great connections. And in the case, for example, of Motherwell and Judd, are almost at odds with each other as far as how they looked at art, their intention. But it makes for a great show. So thank you for your thoughtful consideration of how to put this together.
You're very welcome.
Tell us more about Motherwell. We haven't talked about him too much. That's Robert Motherwell.
Right. And Robert Motherwell was a very scholarly, very mm-hmm. literary.
Professorial
type. Artist. He studied literature and philosophy at Stanford and Harvard, getting degrees from both those places. And he was very influenced by Alfred North Whitehead. And for those of you who in the philosophy world, you'll know him as a prominent American philosopher. And it was Whitehead that actually challenged Motherwell to think about abstraction. And which directly related to Motherwell's work, then artwork. As so abstraction as a way of stripping away the inessential and presenting only the necessary. And this really became the foundation for the abstract expressionists that gathered in New York after World War II.
And, you know, that's really interesting when you mention that, because we think of sculpture as, for example, as a, it can be a negative process where you have a block of marble, for example, and Michelangelo felt that his job was to remove the marble,
the image inside,
in order to reveal what was inside. So that's what we call a negative way of constructing an object. And so Motherwell is doing this with the two-dimensional paintings, taking away, taking away, taking away until you just reveal what is meant to be there.
Right. And then it becomes a very minimal, very essential gesture or image. Motherwell did a lot of black and white paintings early on. And
a lot of the Spanish elegiac paintings. For the Spanish Revolution.
That's right. And he hung out with Roberto Mata in Mexico, and he did a lot of his stuff there. You know, it's sort of interesting because he sort of moved with this minimal concept through he wanted to reveal emotional truths and authentic feelings. So you can see that in a piece that he's that we have at the gallery that's going to be showing. It's called Black Sounds. So he uses shapes as elements to create a rhythm. So, and this expresses a mood rather than representing an image or an object. Now, Judd,
this
completely
is just the
opposite. He didn't want any emotionality in the work. He just, you know, he...
No platonic truths for Judd, right?
No, he was just totally into the object as an essential
as
element.
As it occupies time and space.
As it occupies time and space, and it was really enough for him. So his work is very, very architectural. And... You know, he just wanted to depersonalize art. And
but at the same time, it was about the human experience with the object.
Yes.
For Judd.
It was your relationship to the object.
Not your relationship to the emotions that it might bring up.
Correct. So it was very, you know, again, it was in a very minimal kind of experience there. And yet he hated that term. But so many people refer to him as, you know, the father of minimalism.
Right.
Because he did write that treatise called Specific Objects. And that treatise actually talks about that whole movement, the whole minimal, you know, ethos. And so, you know, each one of these artists, but again, they're all using black. They're all using black as a very elemental, because color always... instigates emotion, generally.
That's certainly what Kandinsky taught us.
Right. And so black then being a very neutral way of making marks and then adding color, that was, you know, then Soulages did that and, and they all added color. But black was the basis
and
for their paintings.
There's always for me with black, there's that reference to charcoal drawing and the gesture of the hand of the artist, which takes us again back to prehistoric cave imagery.
Right.
Where I think one of the most fascinating and moving things about seeing that kind of prehistoric imagery is the idea of imagining a person living thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago in what we would consider to be very primitive conditions, still having that very human urge to express through the hand. And the color black contains all of that, as well as the elements of the night and mystery.
Yeah. And you know, also what was available. The black would probably have come from charcoal, from the fires and that sort of thing. And a lot of artists use charcoal directly from their fireplaces, you know. I mean, it's just a very basic, it's that basic black thing. And, you know, I think it's fun to, you know, this is January. January is usually very sort of a minimal time.
Winter.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think it's a great time to come and look at black paintings, black drawings, black space, because it's always filled with light.
And it's a very expansive-looking show, although I think people might be listening, black, 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 and thinking, no, ooh, well, it's already...
There's all sorts of
depressing
colors. No, there's all sorts of colors.
And well, that's, again, the expansiveness of pure space, like the universe is black,
and you know,
but not in a negative way.
And then we do have a few other things like Sol LeWitt. We have a blue vertical, which is really black with blue. Francis Morellet did beautiful black drawings. We have two of those, and those are really quite remarkable. Those are from 1970, which is, you know, coming up now. Those are, you know, about 45 years old.
I know.
It's amazing.
Crazy.
And we also have Ed Ruscha, you know, so that's fun. And we have a Frankenthaler, which is primarily black.
That's kind of unusual for her.
It is. But with a little bit of yellow in it. It's called Yellow Jack. So check that one out, too. Because
is that a stained piece?
No, it's a lithograph. But it does have that quality, you know, sort of a wash, you know, over. So there are different tones of black in it.
Which, again, people don't always understand. They think black is black. But, boy, if you've ever worked in the retail business selling clothes, you realize there's
many different
way
colors.
Too many shades of black.
Many
so anyway, I know you and I could just go on
we
and on. But
we could.
We've run out of time. So we're talking with Meg Hockman from Zane Bennett Contemporary Art about the exhibition Black Space that just opened at Zane Bennett Gallery in the Rail Yard. And you've been listening to Art Beat on Talk 1260 KTRC. This is Catherine Davis, and I will talk to y'all next week.